This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hello, this is Gordon Burnside of Mind's Eye reading the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, April 25th, 2024. The journal's top story today carries this headline: Trump advisors, including Giuliani and Meadows, indicted in Arizona. A grand jury indicted 18 of the former president's allies for their alleged efforts to overturn his 2020 election loss in the state. The article is by Jan Wolf. Several of former President Donald Trump's closest advisors, including Rudy Giuliani and Mark Meadows, were indicted in Arizona following a year-long criminal investigation into their alleged efforts to overturn Trump's November 2020 election defeat in the state. Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, a Democrat, said Wednesday that a state grand jury approved criminal charges against 11 Republicans who submitted a document to Congress falsely declaring that Trump had carried the battleground state. Seven other people were also charged in the indictment, but their names were redacted because they hadn't yet been served with court papers. Portions of the indictment describing those seven individuals make clear that they include Giuliani, Trump's former lawyer, and Meadows, former White House chief of staff. I understand that for some of you, today didn't come fast enough, and I know I'll be criticized by others for conducting this investigation at all, Mays said in a recorded statement. But, as I have stated before, and will say again here today, I will not allow American democracy to be undermined. It's too important. Representatives for Giuliani and Meadows didn't respond to a request for comment. Joe Biden won Arizona by more than 10,000 votes in 2020, flipping a state that Trump won in 2016 against Hillary Clinton. The Arizona charges come after similar indictments in Nevada, Georgia, and Michigan. Every 4 years, Americans cast their votes not directly for presidential candidates, but for electors pledged to those candidates in the Electoral College. In December of every election year, the electors meet in their respective states, cast their votes, and send those votes to Congress for formal certification. The 11 people who had been nominated to be Arizona's Republican electors met in Phoenix on December 14, 2020, to sign a certificate saying they were the state's duly elected and qualified electors. GOP officials in the state documented the signing of the certificate in a social media post and sent it to Congress and the National Archives. Those 11 people have now been charged with crimes in Arizona, including fraud, forgery, and conspiracy, Mays said on Wednesday. The defendants include several influential figures in Arizona politics, including former state GOP Chair Kelly Ward and sitting state senators Anthony Kern and Jake Hoffman. Democrats have called these individuals fake electors, saying they engaged in a brazen scheme to subvert democracy. Participants in the effort have objected to the term fake electors, saying that they relied on legal advice grounded in historical precedents. They have said the certificates were a legitimate way of preserving objections to a contested election in case Trump was eventually declared the winner through court challenges. Trump, who isn't charged, is repeatedly referred to as unindicted co-conspirator one in a 58-page indictment. The indictment said the defendants schemed to prevent the lawful transfer of the presidency to keep unindicted co-conspirator one in office against the will of Arizona's voters. The 18 defendants in the Arizona case also include attorneys John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, and Christina Bobb, as well as longtime Trump advisor Boris Epstein and Trump 2020 campaign official Mike Roman. Charles Burnham, a lawyer for Eastman, said his client will fight the charges against him as he has all the other unjust accusations leveled against him. Representatives of the other defendants didn't respond to requests for comment. The Arizona prosecution bears some similarities to the racketeering case brought against Trump and 18 co-defendants in Georgia last year, which has so far produced 4 guilty pleas. The remaining defendants in the Georgia case include Meadows, Giuliani, Eastman, and Roman. They have pleaded not guilty. Eastman, a former law professor, was an architect of Trump's post-election legal strategy. Last month, a California judge formally recommended that Eastman lose his law license for his role in Trump's efforts to remain in power. Giuliani, New York City's former mayor, had his law license suspended in 2021 after a court found that he had made demonstrably false claims while representing Trump in an election lawsuit. And here comes another headline from today's Wall Street Journal. This one says, pro-Palestinian protests mount at college campuses across the U.S. Discussions continue between Columbia University and pro-Palestinian demonstrators. The article is by Alyssa Lukpot, Aaron Aylworth, and Suryatapa Bhattacharya, Dateline, New York. Pro-Palestinian protests took root on university campuses across the country Wednesday as tensions remained high between students and administrators at Columbia University. Columbia gave demonstrators until tonight to disassemble an encampment there following almost a week of protests that the university has struggled to contain. It initially set a deadline of midnight Wednesday before extending it. The university said discussions between the school and protesters are continuing, and the student demonstrators have agreed to take down some of their tents. The protests began in response to Columbia President Manoush Shafiq's congressional testimony last week over whether the school has done enough to protect Jewish students. House Speaker Mike Johnson and a delegation of GOP lawmakers appeared Wednesday on the Columbia campus, where the Louisiana Republican condemned anti-Semitic hate and mob mentality. He also called for Shafik to resign if she cannot immediately bring order to this chaos. Johnson's speech was met with chants and jeers from the gathered crowd. Johnson responded by telling the crowd to enjoy their free speech. Columbia's Board of Trustees said it supports Shafik in a statement released after Johnson's remarks. During the search process for this role, President Shafik told us that she would always take a thoughtful approach to resolving conflict, balancing the disparate voices that make up a vibrant campus like Columbia's, while taking a firm stance against hatred, harassment, and discrimination, the board said. That's exactly what she's doing now. Meanwhile, students at other schools, including Brown University, Emerson College, Harvard University, the University of Southern California, and the University of Texas, are holding protests and establishing encampments. Administrators at Emerson College, which has an urban campus in Boston, abutting public property, said they were concerned that the protesters are risking legal consequences beyond Emerson's control when they don't abide by city and state laws. Of additional concern, Emerson has received credible reports that some protesters are engaging in targeted harassment and intimidation of Jewish supporters of Israel and students, staff, faculty, and neighbors seeking to pass through the alley, a statement from President Jay Bernhardt and other school officials said. This type of behavior is unacceptable on our campus. At Harvard, hundreds of protesters assembled Wednesday in Harvard Yard, the heart of the school's Cambridge, Massachusetts campus, according to the Harvard Crimson. They included organizers of the Palestine Solidarity Committee, which the university suspended on Tuesday, and some protesters had tents, the paper said. The university early in the week had restricted access to the yard to Harvard affiliates with ID cards. The school on posted signs said that structures, including tents, were prohibited without prior permission. At the University of Texas in Austin, police clashed with protesters after the administration attempted to cancel a planned demonstration. Videos from students and local media showed state troopers in riot gear heading off marchers, clashing with them, and appearing to arrest or detain several protesters. Texas Governor Greg Abbott said on X Wednesday that arrests are being made and would continue until the crowd disperses. These protesters belong in jail, said Abbott, a Republican, who added that students joining in what he called anti-Semitic protests at public universities should be expelled. Anti-Semitism will not be tolerated in Texas, period, he said. A Texas Department of Public Safety spokesman said state troopers had arrested more than 20 people. He said state police had been dispatched at the request of both the university and Abbott. The Council on American Islamic Relations chapter in Austin said the right to peacefully protest and express dissenting opinions are fundamental rights and urged police to exercise restraint. The recent arrest of student activists advocating for a ceasefire in Gaza represent a troubling suppression of these rights, the group said in a statement. At Columbia, Shafik has faced growing discontent over her handling of the campus crisis. She said in a letter that she supports the protesters' free speech rights, but the encampment raised safety concerns. Columbia said the university would consider alternative options to clear out protesters if they didn't leave by the initial midnight deadline. Columbia Students for Justice in Palestine organization said the university threatened to call in the National Guard. Columbia said Wednesday deploying the National Guard was never on the table. The school last week summoned the New York City Police Department to control protesters. Columbia University spokesman Ben Chong said on Wednesday that a rumor that the university threatened to bring in the National Guard was baseless, calling it an untrue and unsubstantiated claim. Pro-Palestinian protesters have called on the university to divest from companies with business ties to Israel and for a ceasefire in Gaza. More than 100 people were arrested at Columbia last Thursday, the day the demonstrations kicked off. Daily campus life has largely come to a halt. Jewish students have said they don't feel safe because of an uptick in antisemitism since the war began. Columbia says students could attend class online or in person for the rest of the semester, indicating that it doesn't see the protests ending soon. Students will soon have to focus on studying for final exams, which begin at Columbia on May 3rd. Columbia said it has been in discussions for several days with the student protesters. The students have agreed to prohibit discriminatory language at their encampment and make sure that non-student protesters leave, Columbia said. Tahiya Islam, with the Shut It Down for Palestine coalition, was among the crowd early Wednesday gathered outside Columbia. She led them in a chant, "In our millions, in our billions, we are all Palestinians. Resistance is justified when people are occupied." Noting the police presence nearby and a recent arrest of students at Columbia and NYU, Islam said, "I'm not very surprised by how the U.S. treats its protesters historically." Above the crowd, people inside Columbia looked over a stone ledge where a cardboard sign had been hung, "Free Palestine," and joined in raising their fists and clapping as they echoed the crowd below, chanting, "Say it clear and say it loud, students, you make us proud." Okay, now we're leaving the Wall Street Journal's front page and moving inside its news section, and here we find a headline that says, U.S. fertility rate falls to record low. Fewer babies were born in the U.S. in 2023 than any year since 1979. The article is by Jennifer Kalfas and Anthony DeBarros. American women are giving birth at record low rates. The total fertility rate fell to 1.62 births per woman in 2023, a 2% decline from a year earlier, federal data released today showed. It is the lowest rate recorded since the government began tracking it in the 1930s. The decline reflects a continuing trend as American women navigate economic and social challenges that have prompted some to forego or delay having children. A confluence of factors are at play. American women are having fewer children later in life. Women are establishing fulfilling careers and have more access to contraception. At the same time, young people are also more uncertain about their futures and spending more of their income on home ownership, student debt, and child care. Some women who wait to have children might have fewer than they would have otherwise for reasons including declining fertility. People are making rather reasoned decisions about whether or not to have a child at all, said Karen Benjamin Guzzo, director of the Carolina Population Center at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. More often than not, I think what they're deciding is, yes, I'd like to have children, but not yet. Total fertility estimates the number of children a woman would give birth to in her lifetime. The estimates don't account for what women actually decide in later years, said Brady Hamilton, a co-author of the report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Health Statistics. The number of births last year was the lowest since 1979, according to provisional data. About 3.59 million children were born in the U.S. in 2023, a 2% drop compared with 3.66 million in 2022. The figures are provisional and likely to adjust slightly when final data are released later this year. The total fertility rate peaked during the baby boom after World War II, with a rate of more than 3 births per woman, before falling through the 1960s and 1970s. More recently, the total fertility rate has declined steadily since hitting 2.12 births per woman in 2007, before the financial crisis. The rate in the U.S. has remained generally under or around 2.1 children per woman, or what is known as the replacement rate, since the 1970s. A rate of 1.62 in 2023 marks a new low and a sign of years of decline. Births in 2023 were lower than any year since 1979, the data show. U.S. births edged up slightly during and after the COVID pandemic. The long-term effects of lowering rates could shape the economy, programs including Social Security, and other facets of American life, said Philip Levine, an economics professor at Wellesley College. It has the ability to have a significant impact on the way we live for a long time to come, he said. An influx of people immigrating to the U.S. could offset the impact of lower birth rates on the U.S. population's size, said Hamilton, the report author. Immigration has risen in recent years, easing labor shortages and expanding the population of big metropolitan areas. Birth rates declined more for younger women between 2022 and 2023, according to the provisional data, while those for women in their 40s were unchanged. Women in their mid to late 30s are having children at similar rates to those in their early mid-20s. Birth rates for women 35 to 39 fell to 54.7 births per 1,000 women, closer to the rates for women 20 to 24, which dropped 4% to 55.4 births per 1,000 women in 2023. Some women in their 20s might postpone having children. Despite fertility treatments like in vitro fertilization, egg freezing, and artificial insemination, trying to have children later in life can carry lower odds of success and health risks. And here comes another headline. This one says, Supreme Court weighs emergency abortions in states where procedure is banned. Justices consider doctor responsibilities when pregnant patients are experiencing health crisis. The article is by Jess Braven, Dateline, Washington. The Supreme Court struggled Wednesday with the consequences of its 2022 decision ending the nationwide right to abortion in a case pitting the health of women suffering medical emergencies against an Idaho law that bans the procedure. The state asked the justices to overrule lower court orders allowing doctors to perform emergency abortions when necessary to stabilize a patient. The Biden administration, which sued Idaho, argued that under a federal law governing emergency care, doctors can provide abortions they judge medically necessary to treat a woman experiencing a serious health scare. Idaho's abortion law is stricter, permitting the procedure only to save a woman's life. And on Wednesday, the state's lawyer, Joshua Turner, told the court that it was the state's prerogative to define the scope of permissible medical treatments. Liberal justices challenged that view. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said federal law imposed several duties on emergency rooms beyond state law. So what that means is that when a hospital wants to only provide stabilizing care in emergencies for people who can pay for it, federal law says, no, I'm sorry, you have to stabilize anyone who's experiencing an emergency medical condition, she said. Justice Sonia Sotomayor said that meant states couldn't deny patients care that the medical profession considers necessary. Idaho couldn't say, don't treat diabetics with insulin, treat them only with pills, said Sotomayor, who is diabetic. By the same token, abortion is a treatment for some serious conditions, even if foregoing the procedure won't cause the woman to die, she said. Justice Neil Gorsuch, a member of the court's conservative wing, suggested that the Idaho law wasn't as rigid as it might appear, and that doctors could perform emergency abortions on patients who might be at future risk of dying, but were yet to arrive at death's door. As a condition of accepting Medicare funding, the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act requires emergency rooms to treat people who show up in a medical crisis, including women in labor, to stabilize their condition. The administration argues that the federal law, known as EMTALA, permits the procedure to preserve the patient's health, for instance, if needed, to save the patient's reproductive organs. Idaho argued that the administration's approach would turn emergency rooms into abortion enclaves, a misapplication of a 1986 law designed to prevent hospitals from dumping undesirable patients, such as those without insurance, onto other facilities. Justice Samuel Alito questioned how broad the federal government believed the health exception should extend. Does the term health mean just physical health, or does it mean mental health? Alito asked the administration's lawyer, Solicitor General Elizabeth Prolegar. Let me be very clear about our position, she said. A mental health emergency could never lead to pregnancy termination because that is not the accepted standard of practice to treat such conditions, she said. In a tense exchange, Alito, who wrote the 2022 opinion overruling Roe v. Wade, suggested that EMTALA itself rejected abortion as medical treatment. In its definition of medical emergencies, the statute includes those that place the health of the woman's unborn child in serious jeopardy, Alito said. It seems that the plain meaning is that the hospital must try to eliminate any immediate threat to the child, he said. Performing an abortion is antithetical to that duty. The statute did nothing to displace the woman herself as an individual with an emergency medical condition, Prolegar replied. Turner sought to assure the justices that, in practice, little differed between the requirements of the state and federal laws. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, whose vote may be pivotal in deciding the case, asked whether doctors could be prosecuted for performing an abortion if the state believed it wasn't necessary to save the woman's life. Prosecutors could choose to do so, Turner said, and the courts would decide whether the doctor acted in good faith or used the life-saving exception as a pretext to perform an abortion. The Supreme Court has permitted Idaho to enforce its abortion ban while its appeal proceeds. Prolegar told the court that as a result, several women with medical emergencies had been transported out of state to hospitals permitted to treat their conditions. More than a dozen states have imposed near-total bans on abortion since the Supreme Court overruled Roe v. Wade in its 2022 decision, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. Okay, we're now leaving the Wall Street Journal's news section and moving into its business and finance section. And here we find a headline that says, McKinsey under criminal investigation over opioid-related consulting. Justice Department is investigating the consulting firm's advice to manufacturers of OxyContin and other opioid products. The article is by Alexander Gladstone. The Justice Department is conducting a criminal investigation into consulting firm McKinsey related to its past role in advising some of the nation's largest opioid manufacturers on how to boost sales. Federal prosecutors are also probing whether McKinsey or any of its employees may have obstructed justice in relation to records of its consulting services for opioid producers, according to people familiar with the investigation, which has been ongoing for several years. A grand jury has been impaneled in Virginia as part of the federal investigation into McKinsey's opioid-related consulting, some of the people said. The U.S. Attorney's offices in the Western District of Virginia and the District of Massachusetts are jointly conducting the investigation, the people said. McKinsey declined to comment. The criminal probe centers on consulting advice that McKinsey gave to drug maker clients, including Purdue, Endo International, and Mallinckrodt, that previously sparked mass civil litigation against the firm. Government and private plaintiffs filed hundreds of civil lawsuits in recent years accusing the consulting firm of exacerbating opioid addiction, an allegation that McKinsey has denied. In 2021, McKinsey reached a settlement with all 50 states, 5 U.S. territories, and Washington, D.C., to pay $642 million to resolve civil opioid-related litigation against the firm without admitting wrongdoing. The firm in 2023 reached separate deals totaling $347 million with Native American tribes, public school districts, insurance companies, and municipal governments, also without admitting wrongdoing. In the settlement with state attorneys general, McKinsey said that in order to achieve finality and avoid the inherent cost and risk of litigating in venues across the country, McKinsey chose to be part of the solution to a complex public health crisis by contributing to opioid abatement efforts without admitting liability. McKinsey's former clients, Purdue, Endo, and Mallinckrodt, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy while facing mass lawsuits alleging that they sold drugs through misleading marketing practices and fueled addiction. McKinsey helped Purdue, the closely held maker of the painkiller OxyContin, develop an initiative to boost drug sales and marketing, according to records released after Purdue went bankrupt in 2019. McKinsey consultants advised the company on how to increase sales of its flagship drug, including suggesting that Purdue's sales team make more calls to healthcare providers it knew wrote high volumes of OxyContin prescriptions and spend less time on doctors who prescribed the opioid medication the least, records showed. In August 2013, consultants from the firm sent a memo to Purdue executives with 20 recommendations they said would boost sales of OxyContin by more than $100 million annually. McKinsey advised Purdue that there was significant opportunity to shift sales calls to the highest volume prescribers who, as a group, wrote 25 times as many OxyContin prescriptions on average than their peers, according to the memo included in unsealed court records. McKinsey previously said it stopped doing work on opioid-specific businesses in 2019, and that its work for Purdue was intended to support the legal use of opioids and patients with legitimate medical needs. McKinsey also advised Purdue and Endo on how to target the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs for sales of their products, according to documents made public through the firm's settlements with states and local governments. This advisory work occurred while McKinsey was simultaneously working as a consultant for the VA itself. McKinsey has said that it advised the VA on matters unrelated to opioid procurement. Pharmaceutical companies began marketing opioids as a safe-to-use pain reliever in the 1990s, leading many doctors to prescribe the pills for all manner of injuries and ailments. The volume of pills from Purdue Pharma and other manufacturers that flooded the U.S. is believed to have contributed to the opioid epidemic. Nearly 645,000 people died from overdoses involving opioids from 1999 to 2021, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The U.S. Attorney's Office in the Western District of Virginia successfully prosecuted Purdue and several of its executives in 2007, when the company pleaded guilty to a felony charge of misbranding OxyContin with the intent to defraud or mislead. Purdue separately pleaded guilty in 2020 to three federal felonies related to the marketing and distribution of OxyContin. In 2021, Endo said it received a subpoena from the same U.S. Attorney's Office the prior year, seeking documents related to McKinsey. Endo received a related subpoena in 2021, the company said, in a securities filing without disclosing further details. Endo reached a criminal resolution earlier this year in which it pleaded guilty to a one-count misdemeanor for introducing misbranded drugs into interstate commerce. In tandem with the criminal plea, Endo made a bankruptcy agreement to pay $465 million to the government over 10 years to settle its monetary claims arising from criminal and civil settlements. Mallinckrodt, another of McKinsey's former clients, disclosed last year that it faced a grand jury subpoena from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Western District of Virginia seeking data and information about the company's reporting of orders for suspicious controlled substances. And here comes another headline. This one says, mining giants weigh $39 billion mega deal that could reshape global industry. BHP offers to buy rival Anglo American, which is separately also considering selling its De Beers Diamond unit. The article is by Julie Steinberg, David Winning, and Ben Otto, Dateline, London. Mines producing some of the world's most coveted diamonds, copper, and more, are in play as Anglo American weighs a $39 billion takeover bid and other deal options that could reshape the global industry. Anglo American said late Wednesday that it had received a takeover bid from longtime rival BHP, a bid aimed at bolstering the Australian company's exposure to copper. A deal would be the biggest in the mining industry in years. BHP said its offer valued Anglo American at about $38.8 billion and is contingent upon Anglo American spinning off shareholdings in two South African-listed units. The proposal represents a premium of about 31%, not including the South African-listed units, based on Tuesday's closing prices. Anglo American said it is reviewing the proposal, which it described as unsolicited, non-binding, and highly conditional. Industry participants expect a bidding war as BHP is pushed for a higher price and other large miners throw their hats in the ring. BHP has until May 22nd to make a firm offer, though the deadline can be extended. Shares in Anglo American soared more than 13% on the news in London trading, while BHP slipped about 3%. Separately, the Wall Street Journal reported today that Anglo American has been considering a sale of its storied De Beers diamond unit, which it has valued at more than $7 billion. The company has, in recent weeks, held conversations with potential buyers, including luxury houses and Gulf sovereign wealth funds, according to people familiar with the matter. The twin revelations promised to roil the industry for weeks or more and potentially kick off a spate of deal-making that has long been anticipated. A tie-up between BHP and London-listed Anglo American would illustrate the growing importance of copper, a metal essential to clean energy products, to a sector that has long relied on Chinese industrialization to boost profits. Copper represents some 30% of Anglo American's output, while BHP counts a majority stake in Chile's Escondida, the world's biggest copper mine, among its assets. BHP bought Australian copper and gold miner Oz Minerals for $6.34 billion in May last year, representing its biggest acquisition since 2011. Copper prices are up some 15% so far this year, reflecting expectations that demand for the metal will rise as the world decarbonizes and supply will be constrained. Electric vehicles and wind farms use copper in much greater quantities than gasoline-powered cars and coal-fired power stations. Acquiring Anglo American would also expand BHP's iron ore business, which generates most of its profits. Some analysts said BHP was acting opportunistically. Before Thursday's markets open, Anglo American shares had fallen 47% since April 2022 as weak prices of commodities, including diamonds, nickel, and platinum, and some large impairments of assets drove a steep fall in the company's profit for 2023. In December, Anglo American said it would try to cut $1 billion in costs this year, doubling an earlier target. At the time, some analysts asked executives whether they should consider selling assets as part of a turnaround plan. BHP is likely drawn by Anglo American's lower valuation following the share price fall, credit sites analysts Wen Lee and Michael O'Brien wrote in a research note. From a strategic standpoint, bigger is always better in the metals and mining sector, they said. A De Beers sale would be considerably smaller, though the unit's potential value is all over the map. Anglo-American values it at $7.6 billion, while analyst estimates range from more than $600 million to $4 billion. It is a difficult operation to value because there aren't many businesses like it, and its performance has flagged of late, including causing Anglo to take a $1.6 billion impairment charge in February. De Beers was founded by a group including Cecil Rhodes in 1888. As recently as the 1980s, the company controlled more than 80% of the world's diamond supply. De Beers and his partners produce around one-third of the world's rough diamonds by value, according to its website. Anglo owns 85% of De Beers, while the other 15% is owned by the government of Botswana. Anglo this week said rough diamond production decreased by 23% in the first quarter and lowered this year production guidance to between 26 and 29 million carats, down from 29 million to 32 million carats. BHP's bid for Anglo American is a bet that investors in global mining companies will warm to a new era of mega deals after several ill-timed big acquisitions more than a decade ago led to hefty write-downs and cost some executives their jobs. China's industrialization had raised expectations of a prolonged boom in commodity prices, which subsequently fell sharply as miners raced to add supply. And here comes another headline. This one says, Boeing burns through $4 billion of cash and scales back 737 MAX production. Aircraft maker has slowed factory to fix quality problems after the door panel blowout. The article is by Sharon Turlip. Boeing burned through nearly $4 billion in the most recent quarter as fallout from the Alaska Airlines mid-air accident exacted a financial toll. The jet maker reported a $355 million loss as revenue fell 8% from a year ago in quarterly results that were slightly better than expected. Under pressure from airlines and regulators to clean up its operations, Boeing has slowed its factories and has stopped providing most financial targets. Near term, yes, we are in a tough moment, outgoing Chief Executive Dave Calhoun said in a message to employees. Lower deliveries can be difficult for our customers and for our financials, but safety and quality must and will come above all else. Boeing is building fewer of its 737 MAX jets as the company weeds out quality problems at the Renton, Washington factory that makes the planes. The company faces added inspections and heightened regulatory scrutiny following the January 5th near tragedy. It delivered 83 commercial airplanes in the March quarter, a 36% drop from a year ago. The production slowdown of the best-selling planes means that the company's operations are burning cash. Boeing warned investors last month that it would take a hit of between $4 billion and $4.5 billion for the year's first quarter, larger than it previously forecast. The company ended March with $7.5 billion of cash and investments, less than half what it had at the start of the year. Moody's Investor Service on Wednesday downgraded its rating on Boeing's unsecured debt by one notch to Baa3, the lowest investment grade level. Moody's expects that cash flow pressures will persist through 2026, and Boeing will have to issue new debt, including if it reaches a deal to acquire Spirit AeroSystems. Boeing executives said Wednesday that they are monitoring liquidity levels and can access additional funds if needed. Meantime, Boeing faces a separate problem with its 787 Dreamliner. A shortage of some key parts means that the company can't increase production of the wide-body jets as quickly as it had hoped. Shares of Boeing were down 3% at $163.90 in Wednesday mid-afternoon trading following the release of the quarterly results. The shares have slumped more than 35% so far this year. This has been Gordon Burnside of Mind's Eye reading the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, April 25th, 2024.